From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. The national conversation on the future of the Supreme Court is heating up as the White House is now vetting possible nominees to replace Justice Antonin Scalia. Senate Republicans have vowed not to consider any Obama pick to replace the late justice on the high court. The standoff raises important questions. Is the nation on the verge of a constitutional crisis? How will the controversy affect the presidential campaigns? What happens to several important cases now pending before the court? We've invited three prominent experts to discuss these questions and many more, I suspect. Joining us now, Gabe Roth, founder of Fix the Court, a nonpartisan grassroots organization that advocates for greater transparency and accountability among the Supreme Court justices. Melissa Murray, law professor at the University of California at Berkeley, who clerked for Justice Sonia Sotomayor at the appeals court level. And Justin Driver, a law professor at the University of Chicago and former clerk to Justices Sandra Day O'Connor and Stephen Breyer.
Let me start with the obvious place, the death of Justice Scalia. Let me just run down the line. We'll start with you first, Melissa. What do you all make of this fight in Washington? I was trying to find a good adjective, but it is mind-boggling to me that we've been in this space of a fight about whether or not the president should or should not appoint his replacement. What do you make of this whole drama?
Well, in a way, it's sort of an extrapolation of a fight we've been having for years. Mm-hmm. I mean, we've been having this fight over lower court nominees. We've been having this fight over public policy. So this is just gridlock extrapolated to the nth degree. Mm-hmm. Right? I mean, this is just a larger version of what we've seen for the last 5 years.
Yeah. But does it seem ironic to you that they celebrated Justice Scalia for being such a strict constitutionalist, and now they want to trample on that same Constitution?
Well, there is sort of the brush of irony mm-hmm. is thick here, and they are painting with it. But again, I mean, Mitch McConnell before had spoken about wanting to fill recess appointments, and now he's like, we're not filling anything until the new president is in place. So there's a lot of flip-flopping. It definitely feels political. And for those who have been saying that the court does nothing but call balls and strikes, I think we're seeing very clearly the court is as much a political branch as any of the other two.
Yep. Gabe, how long do you think they can actually hold out this strategy? My sense is that strategy is going to fall apart at some point, the Republican strategy of not taking this seriously.
I mean, I think they can try to hold it out for many months and even into 2017, delay a hearing, then delay a vote, then a third of the Senate has to go back to their states to run for re-election. This could go on for even over a year. And I think the idea that a near 80-year-old's death is causing a near constitutional crisis in the country is ridiculous. And that's why there should be fixed terms to the Supreme Court. And we shouldn't have justices serving for 25, 30 years, as is the current case right now.
Yeah. I don't know that this question is somewhat political. I'm going to ask it anyway, though, Gabe. Because what would it say about the Obama administration and, for that matter, about the country, about we the people, if they could enact that strategy successfully? I mean, it's clearly a violation of the Constitution. And even with all the strategy to delay, there's no good reason that they should be able to get away with that if the opposition to that is strong and organized.
That's true. There should be a process. And there are a number of different ways that we can look at it. If the president nominates someone that is maybe the Republicans deem too liberal, maybe that person would withdraw and there would be a consensus pick. There are individuals in the country who are federal judges that aren't painted in these strokes of very liberal or very conservative. Maybe there could be, and that's my hope, frankly. The justice, you know, just like you wouldn't want your infield to be missing a second baseman, you don't want the Supreme Court to be missing a ninth justice. So hopefully over time and sooner than before the next president is inaugurated, they will find a consensus pick and fill the bench.
And yet, Justin, I can't speak for all of America, but I speak for myself. I would not want my president, this president especially, to put forth a nominee just for the sake of getting him or her through because he or she were a consensus candidate. Because you go too far with a consensus candidate, you end up with Scalia potentially.
Yeah, well, one of the interesting things here is that Vice President Biden gave an interview not long ago talking about the process that unfolded in 1987 and 1988 after two of Reagan's nominees had gone down in the form of Bork and Douglas Ginsburg. Mm-hmm. And Biden talked about being brought into the Oval Office and having a conversation with Reagan where Reagan said, well, who's going to be able to make it through? And according to Biden, he gave a relatively straightforward account of this person has a real possibility and this person is a loser. And so it's striking that over a relatively short period of time, things have changed dramatically because I haven't heard anything about Senator Grassley making a B-run toward the Oval Office. And it is important as well to think about what are the consequences down the line, assuming that this delay strategy actually ends up working. Should a Republican be elected president, it seems highly improbable that the Democrats would not try to run out the clock for the next 4 years. And that seems like a very scary proposition for our nation.
Yeah, Melissa, how do you read that this could end up not just as a constitutional crisis, but the optics on this politically are just so bad?
So I think there are a lot of different ways that this might play out in terms of what the president chooses to do. I mean, you could sort of think about this and a potential nominee being someone who's being set up for what is essentially a suicide mission, mm-hmm. someone who's not going to go anywhere. I think if that's the way you're thinking of it, maybe the president needs to make an appointment that appeals to particular political constituencies. So, for example, Mexican Americans, a large population of the Latino constituency, making an appointment there, watching it go down in flames, and then using that momentum to sort of gin up the electorate for the general election. That's something that you could think of. But Justin is right. The long-term strategy of delay, and I will say the Democrats kind of set a lot of this in motion with filibuster reform. Mm-hmm. This is sort of chickens coming home to roost, and having this play out over the long term is a really sad proposition. Maybe there's a way to end this and just sort of focus on strategically getting what you can out of this process right now, but we're in a bad moment.
And yet there are three or four people that come to mind, they've been written about a lot in the papers of late, three or four folk who come to mind who are currently sitting on the bench, who passed with as close to flying colors as one can have when one goes up for a Supreme Court nomination. I don't know what the argument would be if you just approved this person 2-3 years ago, 96-0 or 98-0 or 90-something-0. How then all of a sudden are they unqualified if the president would nominate for the Supreme Court?
I mean, you could say something like, I was happy to vote for them for a lower appellate court, yeah. but not for the Supreme Court. But I think you're right. What has substantially changed to make you question this person's yeah. credentials? And I think the idea of the Senate looking obstructionist, like, that doesn't play very well in a general election. It doesn't play very well for the Republicans in a general election.
It plays well for their base, yes.
I think so. I think that the speed with which Republican members and the people that they work with came out like within minutes of Scalia's mm-hmm. death saying there's no chance that Obama gets a nominee through. I think that just goes to show the vitriol that the Republican base has towards the current president, and that's going to play out, you know, it maybe play out through repealing Obamacare 50 times, mm-hmm. but, you know, for the remaining 11 months of his tenure, it's going to play out mm-hmm. in the confirmation battle.
What I don't like about this also, Justin, is it seems to me, and you may disagree, I don't know, but it seems to me that this very process, the way the process is being treated or maltreated at the moment, being bastardized, quite frankly, puts the nominee in a very difficult and tricky situation. Melissa mentioned earlier, you might put somebody up who goes essentially on a suicide mission, but even if that person is appointed, not that we're naive and think that people don't have different points of view on how they interpret the law, but this makes this particular nominee awfully political to begin with.
It's an interesting point. This person would be incredibly politicized. One scenario that I've heard floated is that there would be hearings on someone before the election, and then should a Democrat win the White House, that person would in effect be renominated, having already had the hearings and have a vote on that person. It's a very interesting proposition, because I would think that the last thing that an incoming president wants to deal with is a Supreme Court nomination in a protracted hearing process during the first 100 days when they have an ambitious legislative agenda that they want enacted. So these are very distressing times in which we find ourselves. There's no two ways about it. And it is an open question as to who wants to put themselves through it, this grinder, this meat grinder of a process, when there may be no pot of gold at the end of the rainbow, right?
So, Gabe, before I move on here, and I'm not a conspiracy theorist, so I don't want to get involved in that, but there are some legitimate, I think, questions starting to be raised now about this trip that Justice Scalia was on in Texas.
Sure.
And whether or not it was a free trip and whether or not it was a favor of a friend who happened to get a favorable decision from the court a year prior. I mean, again, this goes to the politicization of the court, which we act as if doesn't exist.
Sure.
But what do we know about this, or where do you see this investigation headed, and where might this come out?
Well, I like to take a step back and think about just the justices' trips as a whole. It's not like the executive office or even in Congress where there's a specific body within the federal judiciary that says you can go on this trip, you can't go on this trip, you can get meals and lodging from it. There's no process. It's sort of a catch-as-catch-can. And specifically with the Scalia trip, even, you know, whatever benefits he might have received from it, we the public aren't going to know for many, many months when his financial disclosures come out. And it's really murky as to whether or not he has to even report all of the benefits that he got from Poindexter, who hosted him at this ranch. It's unclear to what extent he is even required to report that, because a lot of the laws that require federal judges to report certain trips don't apply to the Supreme Court. So that's something that I think we should look at moving forward, is to ensure, how do we ensure the same level of accountability for the 9 Supreme Court justices that we do for the rest of the federal bench?
Is that near the top of your list of things that need to be done to fix the court? Or where does that rank on your list?
Probably 4 or 5, to be honest. I mean, I think that you know, the two most salient issues, I think, are the fact that the justices are serving longer than ever, and the Supreme Court is not acting like an Article III branch. They're acting, you know, way ahead of Congress in Article I and way ahead of the president in Article II. Their decisions on, you know, who votes, who can marry, life or death, these issues are things that Congress used to deal with, the president and the executive branch used to deal with. Now, final say, Supreme Court, there's no review, there's no talk between the branches. So with that power comes a lot more responsibility. And we think, instead of having these undemocratic tenures of 30, 35 years, reducing that to something more reasonable, like 15 or 18, is something that should be done.
One reason I wanted to have this conversation is because it seems like we're in a moment, aside from the wanton hubris of this whole fight about whether or not the president ought to do his constitutional duty and appoint somebody, it seems to me that this might be a moment in time for us to get a real conversation going, perhaps, about what's wrong with the court beyond Antonin Scalia's death. What's wrong with the court? How it ought to be fixed? Let's take that issue then that you've just put on the table for our consideration tonight. Melissa, your thoughts first on whether or not the time has come for us to reconsider these justices having lifetime appointments.
Well, so it's an interesting proposition. I think we have to grapple with Article 3 in the Constitution. I know Gabe disagrees with this, but I don't know how you float a proposal like that without amending the Constitution, which specifically provides for lifetime tenure for federal judges. We ought to think about this in retrospect, though. The Supreme Court is purposefully set up as an anti-democratic institution, which is not to say it's against democracy, but it is supposed to be outside of the political process. Mm-hmm. Judges are supposed to be insulated from the political process and therefore be more independent. That's something I think you can have with lifetime tenure, but there is something to be said for someone having a long period on the court, getting to understand the job, getting to understand longevity and longitudinal aspect of decisions, and being able to make better decisions at time 2 in his or her tenure versus time 1. So I get the allure of term limitations, but we haven't needed them in the past. The fact that the longevity of justices is getting longer, I don't know that necessarily means we have to completely change course and do something as drastic as that, especially something that would require a sea change in the Constitution.
But if you consider, Justin, that when the Constitution was written, that the lifespan of Americans wasn't anywhere near what it is right now, One could make a legitimate argument. I hear Melissa's point that it takes a constitutional amendment to make that happen, and that ain't the easiest thing to get done in this country, obviously. It's why we don't change the Constitution every 2 or 3 years. But what about this notion that that these terms are getting longer, these lifespans are getting longer, so the terms are getting longer, and that we ought to rethink that?
It's a very interesting idea. It's not one that I am especially drawn to myself. Mm-hmm. The reason for that being precisely what Melissa said, which is we want justices not to be thinking about what they're going to do on the backside of their Supreme Court career. We want them to focus on that time. And a common term that's thrown out there is 18 years, and I think that some justices are just hitting their stride at the end of 18 years.
And some aren't, but I'm not going to call any names.
That's very good of you. Holmes was on the, Justice Holmes was on the court for a very long period of time, wrote some of his finest opinions well after 18 years. The other thing that I would worry about by having specific terms is that it would have the justices acquire a mindset that says, well, what can I accomplish during my 18 years here? Or I've only got 2 years to go. And they sort of acquire an agenda and this sort of thing. And the court thinks of itself as being a relatively slow-moving institution. Stability is important, not something that's about sort of herky-jerky and moving all around. And I worry that introducing 18 years could ratchet up some of those concerns.
You don't think that Roberts or Scalia or Thomas or others, for that matter, when they hit the court not knowing how long they were going to live or serve, that they came without an agenda, they didn't think that they didn't see themselves as having an opportunity to have an impact on the way this country is going to change. You think that whoever this next nominee is doesn't understand that they could change the balance of the court? So you say, my point is that you don't have to serve a lifetime to not have an agenda. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I completely hear what you're saying. I'm not saying that these are blank slates and that the reason that these folks get the job often is because they are part of the political community and everything. Mm-hmm. So it's not to say that they but it changes the horizon for what they can accomplish and encourages them to make sort of sudden, dramatic shifts. You know, we're in a very interesting moment right now with respect to Chief Justice Roberts, who has said he wants to focus on judicial minimalism, having a big group of justices go along together and not decide things by sort of narrow majorities. It's possible that he right now is filled with regret about not actualizing his agenda with respect to affirmative action, say, right? Mm-hmm. It's easy to think that you think, well, hey, we've got the votes now. There's no real rush. And then things change rather dramatically with Justice Scalia's death. So it'll be interesting to see what happens with the University of Texas case along that dimension.
Yeah, another way to think about it is with term limits, you have every justice acting the way, you think about a president acting. Like, what's my legacy for the next 4 years? What's my legacy at the end of 8 years? And that's not what the court it's about.
I get it, but my point is, I don't mean to be naive here, but I don't think they don't think about that anyway, not knowing how long they're going to live.
But it's a longer lifespan, I think, and then like understanding that. I think Gabe has some great ideas for reforming the court: transparency, cameras in the courtroom. I think all of those things could make the Supreme Court and its work much more palpable for the American people. I don't think term limits is necessarily the first thing on my list of how to make the court more relevant and how to fix it.
So let's talk about transparency then. What troubles you, Gabe, most about the lack of transparency vis-a-vis the Supreme Court?
Sure. So the Supreme Court is supposed to be a place where individuals, no matter where they live in the country, can come have their grievances aired before, the last stop in our judicial system. Mm-hmm. But only about a couple hundred people can fit in the courtroom to actually watch justice in action. There's a broadcast media ban, as you probably well know. That's why there's no B-roll of the Supreme Court, of the justices in action. And the fact that, we're out here in L.A. and we can't watch what's going on. What we couldn't watch the affirmative action case that was argued earlier this year that you mentioned. You couldn't watch some of the other cases that are coming down the pike on immigration and abortion. We believe that the American people would benefit, as Professor Murray said, if they saw the justices in action, if they had live audio, same day audio, television in the courtroom, and were able to see the justices grapple with these quintessential American issues.
So Justin, You take Gabe's point here about a lack of transparency on the part of the court?
I am completely sympathetic to the idea that cameras belong in the courtroom. It is a scandal that here we are in the year 2016 and people can't tune in to watch oral arguments. The arguments that people make in order to explain why cameras don't belong in the courtroom are, in my estimation, completely unpersuasive. Some people talk about, well, Supreme Court justices treasure their anonymity, and the idea that one can hold public office and be anonymous at the same time doesn't necessarily go together. The other claim that people make is that it's going to lead to sort of grandstanding in the Supreme Court of the United States. I was a law clerk there for a year. There was plenty of grandstanding, right? I didn't see an absence of grandstanding, so you don't need cameras in order to grandstand.
Maybe that's the point, though, that they don't want that grandstanding to be aired.
It's possible. I don't think that the justices would alter the questions that they ask. In many ways, they are speaking to each other more than they are speaking to, I don't know, some sort of hypothetical camera or even the counsel that's before them. They're thinking about trying to set the agenda for the conference where they meet to decide how they're going to resolve the cases that are before them. So I think that there are some, I think this is a very serious and important issue. And the court is, I think, being short-sighted in not bringing the cameras in because there's been talk about effectively forcing cameras into the courtroom, and they don't want that precedent. I'm quite confident about that.
Melissa?
Yeah, I have said this for years. In fact, when I was a law student, we had this audience with Ruth Bader Ginsburg, and I asked this question, why don't you have cameras in the courtroom? And that was her response. We treasure our anonymity, our privacy. This is the highest court in the land. Americans need to understand what it does. And so few Americans actually understand the work of the court. And I think cameras would go a long way to educate the people about what the actual work of the Supreme Court is.
I guess the question is whether or not we think in our lifetimes, Gabe, we will see any movement on this camera in the court issue. This has been going on for a long time. And I think, not that my opinion matters per se, but I think there, if you're going to have cameras in the courtroom, there's a way to do that. You might not want network cameras in the courtroom because I understand, why they might be hesitant about that. But C-SPAN has done, I think, provided a wonderful service to the country by covering. You remember at one point they didn't want cameras in Congress. They didn't want cameras in the House. And the Senate held out for a long time on cameras in the Senate. But I think that C-SPAN has done the country a great service by having cameras in Congress. I wonder whether or not you think that in our lifetimes we'll see traction on this issue of cameras in the courtroom.
I absolutely think so. I think when you have justices who are younger, who grew up with television, who grew up around video and smartphones where there's this constant expectation that you're going to be filmed for something or another. Mm-hmm. And to talk about Congress, right? So Congress uses C-SPAN as a vehicle. They get on C-SPAN, they show these charts, they say things that they know are going to be used for maybe positive and negative in their ads. It's not the case for the justices. Mm-hmm. If they go on TV while they're in session, they're just broadcasting their hearings to the country. There's no electoral repercussions for being on TV. So it's different. So, I've heard from members of Congress that say, oh, we don't want it to be like C-SPAN with all the bickering. Cameras in appellate courts across the country and across the world are as intrusive as wall-mounted clocks. And I think that when a generational change occurs on the court, it'll happen. So hopefully in the next handful of years.
Yeah. I'm about to start a project. We haven't even announced it publicly yet, but we're getting close to announcing a project that we're going to be doing that has to do, Justin, specifically with why so many Americans are trusting less and less our court system. Thoughts about that? About why Americans are becoming more and more concerned about, I think, the politics that aren't supposed to be inside the Supreme Court?
The court's decision in Bush versus Gore, I think, is one of the most memorable decisions of the last 15 or 16 years, and it may well play some role. I also think, actually, that the cameras in the courtroom are a potential solution to some of the erosion of support in the sense that people who go to watch oral arguments think that the justices are taking these cases very seriously. And so rather than viewing them as incredibly invasive and going to make the court worse, it's possible that that would help to arrest their declining trends.
Your thoughts, Melissa, about the sanctity, and I mean that sincerely, of having a court system, a Supreme Court that is trusted, that has the confidence of the American people?
Well, I was thinking of Bush v. Gore when Justin said it. I think there's a larger question about what is the role of the court in democratic life. And there are some who think that you know, the court is just there to interpret the law without sort of recognizing that interpretation is by itself an act that has incredibly political and ideological dimensions, like regardless of how you think about it. Do we want a court that just sort of calls balls and strikes, or do we, you know, want a court that sort of takes up an issue because it needs to be taken up in that moment, like the Brown court, for example? Like, we could have waited for years, but the court saw an injustice and interpreted the Constitution in a way that remedied that injustice. And I think it really just depends on what kind of role you think the court should be playing. And that question has been decided along ideological lines over the last couple of years. And this particular brouhaha that we're in right now is just another manifestation of that.
We are in clearly a brouhaha right now when it comes to the U.S. Supreme Court and who will sit in that seat now vacant due to the death of Justice Antonin Scalia. Gabe, there is some data that I've seen that suggests that Americans are even concerned about the politicization of the Supreme Court. Your thoughts about that data, which can't be encouraging for any of us.
No, it's not. The Supreme Court has record low approval ratings, and I think that's a problem. I think that speaks to Chief Justice John Roberts and his role as the Chief Justice. There have been tons of 5-4 decisions, very political, very expected lines. The Republican appointed justices do one thing, the Democratic appointed justices do another thing. And I think what the American people want is a court that is able to come to consensus on important issues to the country, that these 5-4 decisions don't help out anybody. They don't give us confidence in the highest court. And I think that partially because the court doesn't really conform to modern expectations of transparency, additional questions are asked in terms of what their role is and how they've become so powerful and what can be done to sort of rein that in. And I think a lot of that falls to Chief Justice Roberts, who unfortunately in his 10 years hasn't really been able to form the same types of consensus that maybe we would have hoped so coming in.
And that, Justin, is what scares the Republicans so. That's why there is this fight about whether or not the president has the authority to do his, as I see it, constitutional duty.
I plan to fulfill my constitutional responsibilities to nominate a successor in due time. Now, there will be plenty of time for me to do so and for the Senate to fulfill its responsibility to give that person a fair hearing and a timely vote. These are responsibilities that I take seriously, as should everyone. They're bigger than any one party. They are about our democracy. They're about the institution to which Justice Scalia dedicated his professional life and making sure it continues to function as the beacon of justice that our founders envisioned.
This fight has broken out because they know, Republicans know, that if Obama nominates someone and puts someone who sides with those other Democrat-appointed justices, that 5-4 split will go the other way. One, how concerned are you about that? And number two, how long do you think, if and when that happens, before the country starts to feel the reversal of some of these decisions and cases 5-4 the other way?
So I think that a lot of the frustration that Republicans have about the Supreme Court is the number of nominees and justices who have been appointed by Republicans, but over time drift to the left. And so they feel like everybody from Blackmun to O'Connor on affirmative action to Justice Kennedy on gay rights, they get all of these nominees. Indeed, after Thurgood Marshall was confirmed, the next 10 Supreme Court justices were all Republican-appointed justices. And so then they come along to John Roberts, this person who was sent from Central Casting to be their Chief Justice, and there's frustration because he doesn't invalidate Obamacare in the ACA. So I think that accounts for a lot of the frustration on the right. Would the court change on a dime? I sort of doubt it, but it does if Obama's nominee were to be confirmed. But it would put a lot of issues in play that were thought not to remotely be possible, including maybe capital punishment. Justice Breyer, for example, last year wrote an important opinion suggesting that it's at least plausible that capital punishment should be understood to violate the Eighth Amendment. So there is a great deal that would be put in play as a result of Obama getting somebody confirmed.
Yeah. How long, Melissa, do you think before the country would feel the impact of the Obama nominee, when that happens eventually?
I don't know that it's like a seismic shift. I do think that you'd start to see some subtle changes. I mean, I think it will change the dynamic among the justices themselves. I don't think we will see the pandering to Justice Kennedy. He's not the swing justice anymore, and I think that's a huge shift. I think it would also change the assignments in terms of Kennedy would now become the most senior associate justice. So when the chief justice is in the minority, he would make the assignments of different opinions. So I think those are sort of subtle changes that would happen. I don't think you would see the kind of tectonic shift that would, you know, arrest the public and sort of like this is a new kind of court. But I do think you would see changes at the margin.
Yeah. You know, the irony, one of the ironies for me on this, Gabe, is that, and I think we all know this, that over the last couple of years, there's been an increasing amount of pressure placed on Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg to step down while Obama was in the White House so that he would have the opportunity to replace her with someone younger who could serve for many years to come. And she has repeatedly said, I'm not going anywhere. I'm in good health. I enjoy my duties. I feel like I'm still contributing. She said in more than one way, I am not stepping down from this position. And then, out of nowhere, Justice Scalia dies on a hunting trip, and the president still gets a chance, not just to put another justice on, but to, you know, to change in many people's minds the direction and future of the court. But that's an interesting irony to me that she refused to step down, and he gets another bite at the apple anyway.
That's right. That's right. She's been on the court since 1993. So she's had a very long tenure, very prolific, and really in the last few years she's become this rock star that everyone's talking about. Constant public appearances. There's an opera written about her. Lots of books, and she's really embraced that public role. On the other hand, you know, if you take a step back, I'm just thinking about this now. Why isn't there a body or a commission like is done in the States that would come up with a justice or an individual that's maybe a nonpartisan choice? Like, why are we still, you know, the fact that we're framing these questions so much in partisan ways, like, okay, this is the Reagan justice and this is the Bush justice and the Clinton justice. You know, the idea that, you know, at lower levels, there are these judicial nominating commissions that come up with these consensus picks. The fact that that doesn't happen at the Supreme Court is kind of shame. But, you know, to go back to Ruth Bader Ginsburg, she's been on the court for 23 years. She has a legacy. And who's to say? Who knows what's going to happen with the next president? And it's possible that her legacy could be tarnished because she's choosing not to step down when there was a Democratic Senate. No, it's now held by the Republicans, but potentially with a Republican president, that legacy could be tarnished.
Since you opened this door, I'll follow you in. Your suggestion, notwithstanding, and it's a good suggestion, I think, something worth considering. But are there ways that you think we could make this process less partisan? Are there ways that we can make the nominee less partisan, or did that train leave the station a long time ago and now it's a fight between the left and the right for who controls the court?
I don't know how you would go about fixing that particular issue. I mean, I think that for a long time this process was not especially politicized. Eisenhower put Warren and Brennan on the court, two of our most liberal justices. Ford put Stevens on the court. But increasingly, I think Republicans in particular are saying, we've gotten burned over a long period of time, and we want to make sure that people are not going to go wobbly on us and go soft on us. And, you know, Justice Thomas famously said to his law clerks, apparently, I ain't evolving. By that he meant, of course, I'm not going to drift leftward over time. I'm not going to succumb to the greenhouse effect, named for Linda Greenhouse. Yeah. So I don't see a way to get the politics out of it. And given that the Constitution talks about the president's right, as you've been emphasizing, to nominate, I'm not sure how we would go about getting that out.
Are you as sanguine as as Justin is about this issue?
Yeah, I was, when Justin was speaking, I was thinking of Souter. Like, that's the bogeyman. Souter is the bogeyman, the George H.W. Bush nominee who tilted liberal. I think the other thing is the confirmation process has become so incredibly politicized in a way that it wasn't when Stevens was nominated, when Brennan and when these other older justices were nominated. Like, now it's such a political event. The litmus test about abortion, about gun rights, I mean, I think it's hard to kind of unring that bell at this point.
Do we think that this court is headed in a direction where they are coming to understand, to appreciate, to embrace, vis-a-vis their decisions, where America is at this point in its journey. That's a strange way of I think getting, well, maybe not, I hope it's not too strange. But I guess what I'm getting at is that we've had courts of nine white guys who advanced America in many ways more than the most multiracial, multi-ethnic court we've ever had has done in contemporary times. So I guess, again, is this court, is there evidence to your mind, at least, that this court is headed in a direction where they're starting to understand, appreciate, embrace where America is at this moment in its journey? Does that make sense?
Yeah. I think certain members of the court are there and want to have that conversation. I mean, there was Justice Sotomayor's dissent in the Schwede case where she said, you know, this idea that we are going to get past racism by not ever talking about race is ridiculous. And so I think there are some of them who want to do that. But I mean, I think the other thing that we have to grapple with, and I'm surprised this is not a reform you've taken up more vociferously, but we have a court where everyone went to Harvard, Yale, and Columbia. I mean, that is shocking to me.
And mostly Harvard and Yale.
Mostly Harvard and Yale. I mean, like there are other law schools. I mean, there are other kinds of professions that you could draw justice from. Like, we haven't had a political person since Sandra Day O'Connor, who was a legislator in Arizona, and before that, a state court judge. We haven't had anyone who's sort of a work-a-day prosecutor. I mean, Kamala Harris is a really interesting nomination prospect. I mean, we have career judges on the bench, and career in the most elite sort of sense of the word. Maybe the Supreme Court should look more like the rest of America.
That did. I mean, I can't say it shocked me because, I mean, obviously with each justice, I'm following this. I pay attention to where they went to school when they come up for hearings. But when you look at it on paper, Gabe, all Harvard, all Yale, basically, that's pretty...
It's unrepresentative, exactly. Yeah. And I think that we want to see a little bit of ourselves in the justices. We want to see, you know, and we know some of their struggles, right? I mean, it's they've all written books. They've all gone on TV to talk about the books, not to have their hearings shown on TV. But they've all talked about their books. They've all talked about their life stories. And
so TV's okay when they're selling books.
Correct. That's exactly what they say.
But we
do want the individuals who are making decisions about marriage and voting and healthcare and immigration and abortion to sort of understand where we are. And if you are in those elite legal circles, you may not. So I think that is a problem. And I also wanted to Professor Murray's point about a job diversity. You're right. There are these other types of diversity. While there's, you know, an African American, a Hispanic, three women, three Jews, whatever. You know, the idea that we have someone who was once a U.S. senator or who was a prosecutor like Kamala Harris or Preet Bharara, like, I think that would be a benefit to all of us. And also just, you know, looking up as seeing, like, you know, you and I or any of us could do that one day, and I think that would be
I guess the challenge that I see it is that for a president to take that challenge up and to try to diversify the court, you'd be on demand accused of playing identity politics. Not that should stop you from doing it, but that's the first response you're going to get. Here comes the president trying to play identity politics and not putting the most qualified people on the bench. To that, we'd respond how?
Well, I mean that's tough. I mean, I think that no matter what, he's going to get criticized for whoever the pick is.
Yeah.
So I think he has to pick and choose his battles. You know, if he's going to pick something, you know, if I were counseling the president, I would say pick a federal judge who's already been confirmed 97 or 98 to nothing. Yeah. I mean, I think that's pretty much the line, and I actually think that's the line he's going to take.
Yeah.
Would it be, you know, interesting for him to pick somebody who is potentially a Democratic constituency for a Bernie or a Hillary to help push them over the finish line come next January? Yeah. That's another strategy. Yeah. I mean, I hope we wouldn't look at it like that, but, you know, I think the idea that you want, if you're purely looking at what's the most likely individual to get confirmed, you're going to have to find somebody who's a federal judge who is confirmed nearly unanimously.
It is clear to me that whatever the president does, he will take the route that is most politically expedient. That's my sense of where he's going to end up, but I digress. You're going to say something, Justin.
To your question about whether the court is sort of compatible with the times in which we find ourselves, you know, perhaps not. And the single best case to stand for that proposition would be the Citizens United case with campaign finance, where at a moment when people across the political spectrum are worried about inequality, a decision that increases the political power of corporations is incredibly important. Another thing to think about with respect to diversity on the Supreme Court there's no issue more urgent than criminal justice reform. Mm-hmm. One could imagine it being advantageous for the Supreme Court of the United States to have someone who spent time, not perhaps on the prosecutor side, but on the public defense side, right? Mm-hmm. Someone who's been a public defender, because Sotomayor was a prosecutor, Alito was an AUSA, and those sorts of voices often are not heard, I think, in the conference room about the real toll that is being inflicted upon marginalized members of our society through the criminal justice system.
Let me talk about a few issues in the time that we have. In no particular order, there are cases now that are sort of hanging in the balance while we figure out what we do about this now open seat on the U.S. Supreme Court. Immigration case, abortion case. What am I overlooking here?
Fisher,
affirmative action case. Let's just talk about, we'll start with you, Melissa. Pick one or pick a couple of them and tell me what most concerns you about this period where we don't know where we're headed on these cases.
So I think with the abortion case, Scalia would certainly have upheld Texas provisions on HB 2. I think his absence from the bench leaves it in a place where you have a 4-4 split, so it doesn't make precedent. But it does allow the lower court opinion to stand, and that's huge mm-hmm. for women in Texas. I mean, that basically closes a wide range of reproductive services in Texas, and that's a big important decision, I think, regardless of whether or not it's precedental. The other case, I think, is Fisher, where Scalia's absence from the bench actually may really shape what goes forward in ways that might be advantageous for the survival of affirmative action. So, I mean, I think, you know, there's a mixed bag here, and there's a lot of uncertainty about what happens going forward.
Justin?
Yeah, in the Fisher case, Justice Kagan is recused apparently because of her work in the Solicitor General's office. Mm-hmm. And so with Justice Scalia's death, that means that the court is down to 7 justices. Mm-hmm. And so one could imagine a world in which the justices decide to get rid of this case and dismiss it as improvidently granted. It takes 4 justices to grant cert in order to hear the case. One would think that Justice Scalia would have been one of those justices saying that the University of Texas should not be able to have this affirmative action program. So, Kennedy expressed some frustration during oral argument that the facts didn't seem to be all that different from Fisher 1, and why are we hearing this case? So that's one to think about. On the other hand, arguing it the other way, Roberts himself may say, colorblindness is one of the most important things to him, and he may decide we need to shoot the moon because who knows what the future looks like. And when Kagan is back and perhaps another Obama nominee or another Democratic president, you better get while the getting's good. I don't think that the Supreme Court is going to issue some sweeping decision getting rid of affirmative action across the land, especially when it has just 7 justices, but the incentive arguably is there.
If I could get away with it, Melissa, I would. I mean, I don't have that mindset. But if you have a moment to get away with it, why not?
I think Chief Justice Roberts is so concerned about the legitimacy of the court and the reputation of this court that I can't imagine him. I mean, like, that scenario I can't see playing out. I just think he's much more concerned about the court's reputation. But, I mean, this prospect of a 7 justice bench and this huge issue. I mean, that to me is sort of the most interesting case on the docket. The others, though, I think the idea of a 4-4 split on a lot of these cases, that's bad. Yeah. I mean, allowing those lower court decisions to stand, I think that has real consequences in real people's lives.
What about immigration, Gabe?
Yeah, I think that's another case that's potentially going to play out 4-4, and the fact that it stems from the Obama administration saying, okay, well, we can't get anything through Congress. We can't work with Congress to pass an immigration bill. So we're just going to go out on our own and have this program for undocumented children and sometimes their parents as well. So that is probably going to be a 4-4 split as well. And the lower court, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I think the lower court invalidated Obama's program. But to me, it raises this larger issue of the Supreme Court has become the most powerful, least accountable part of our government. And given that it is, instead of, it's taking the role of Congress, it's taking the role of the president, and it needs to be reined in a little bit. And we need to have reforms across the board to make it more reflective of where it should fall within the constitutional structure.
Melissa, Justin, has the Supreme Court overstepped its bounds, so to speak, its authority, its power, its jurisdiction?
Well, you say it's become this. It's always been this. I mean, it has always been an unelected branch of government that wields, at least since Chief Justice John Marshall, tremendous power through the use of judicial review.
But I think his point, though, is that the dysfunction, I don't know what your point is, my point is, though, I'm going to side with you on this, that the dysfunction in Congress has put more stuff on the docket for the Supreme Court that's put them in a position of having to essentially write more law. And in that sense, maybe they have overstepped their bounds.
And I wouldn't think that when Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act was invalidated, my initial thought was, oh, well, it passed the houses, both houses of Congress when it was reauthorized in 2006 by ridiculous majorities. Sure, so they'll rewrite Section 5 and we'll go from here. That doesn't happen anymore. There's no give and take among the branches, and I think that sort of puts into focus their role, which is overstepping its bounds.
Maybe part of it is that we imagine a functioning government where there is this give and take between the executive and Congress, and that's not happening, and that puts an outsized pressure on the court
that's
to resolve.
Yeah, exactly.
Fair
yeah.
enough.
Yeah.
But that's not because there's something institutionally wrong with the court's position. That's something about the way inter-branch communication is working or not working. And that's a larger story about Washington, not necessarily about reforming the court.
One thing to keep in mind for the time going forward is to think about the relationship between the court and executive authority. And that is very much implicit in the immigration case. For a long time, Republican-appointed justices had a very strong understanding of executive power. The executive can do what it wants. And in more recent times, it seems as though the Republican-appointed justices have been expressing skepticism of the executive, and they added an important question recently about the take care clause and whether the president can do the things that he'd like to do or she'd like to do in carrying out his program. So that's really an important dynamic to think about the Supreme Court and its relationship, not only with respect to Congress, but with respect to the
executive. Whenever I think about the executive branch and the judicial branch, I think all the time, I can see it like it was yesterday. I thought Judge Alito was going to have going to full cardiac arrest, just go apoplectic when Obama was lecturing the Supreme Court while they're sitting on the front row about Citizens United. I mean, that was like a classic picture. He turned almost red at the president, basically just kind of putting them on blast about Citizens United while they're sitting in doing his State of the Union address, but I digress on that. In the 2 minutes I have left, not to make you again a political, but I will, at least you gave. Every election, you hear all the time that this is an important election because the president selects the nominees for the U.S. Supreme Court. Somebody in an election cycle is going to give that as a reason why you should vote.
It's been me this cycle.
Yeah, exactly. This cycle, though, everybody understands, inherently everybody understands that elections do matter because presidents pick Supreme Court nominees. How do you see this issue playing out on the campaign trail?
Well, I think it'll grow as we get into May and June, the end of the Supreme Court term, and you see all these cases being held over. They're going to be re-argued in the coming term because, it'll probably be 4-4 on immigration, 4-4 on affirmative action, 4-4 on either the contraception mandate or the abortion case or both. And that'll bring those specific issues, which are quintessential issues of our democracy and really of the presidential race, because there are stark differences between the parties. I think it'll just not only raise the level of discourse on the court, but also of those specific issues, which, I think will give the voters a real stark contrast between what the Republican vision and the Democratic visions are.
Justin, some thoughts about that?
Yeah, you could imagine President Obama thinking about the electoral implications of nominating a particular justice. You could imagine him thinking that there's going to be upside in nominating one individual so as to spike turnout. And if the Republicans decide to go forward and effectively say, no, we're not going to consider anyone, him thinking, well, I want someone to continue the work that I've begun, and so better get as much sort of bang for the buck at the ballot box out of this nomination because this person's not going to be able to cast votes. Of course, that sets up the Supreme Court in a very difficult position if it's being used as a sort of pawn
Let's be frank, Melissa, the president at this point clearly, whether he acknowledges or not, is thinking legacy. There is a black man on the list who was confirmed, that would be a nice shout out to black people to put another African American who is very different than Clarence Thomas on the Supreme Court.
This is certainly going to be a legacy appointment. I don't think we should just focus on what this might mean for the presidential election. I mean, whatever this appointment and nomination and the process that unfolds from it can do, it's not just going to have repercussions in the presidential election. It could potentially shape the congressional elections.
Sure, sure.
I mean,
absolutely.
There's a chance that if this gets so gridlocked that this turns people out and Congress shifts.
Yeah.
So I think this is, like, elections matter in every sense of the word here.
They do. Mr. Murray, thank you. Gabe Roth, thank you. Justin Driver, thank you for the conversation about what this Supreme Court is going to look like or not look like in the coming months and years.
You can catch me weeknights on my television show on PBS. For more info on what I'm doing or to hear this show, past shows, or the Tavis Smiley Show podcast, visit TavisSmileyRadio.com. The Tavis Smiley Show is a news and opinion program produced and recorded in Los Angeles by SRP Productions in partnership with Public Radio International. Tony Marcano is our executive producer. I'm Tavis Smiley. This is PRI. Keep the faith.